Turn on the cooker. Cooker spelled with a Q U. Turn on the cooker and instantly make a brew. Turn on the cooker. Cooker spelled with a Q U. Turn on the cooker. Water for vegetables too.
Yes, this podcast is sponsored by Cooker, spelt quicker, pronounced cooker, boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It does hot water, it does cold water, it does 100 degree water, it does chilled sparkling water, and does normal chilled water. I've done those the wrong way around, as I normally do.
Doesn't matter. But it does them all.
It does your vegetables,
it does
your brew, it looks great. And I want to thank them so much for sponsoring the podcast. I also use it for cleaning as well, when you've got like a lot of stuff and it's, you know, like you've got meat juices stuck in something. Get the hot water on it. It's safe as well, because it's got a safety device on it. Often people go, aren't you going to burn yourself and scald yourself? No, you don't, because it's got the push and turn feature on it, which means that it's pretty tough to burn yourself on it. You have also to learn how to use it.
Also, ecologically, much more sound than a kettle.
Yeah, it does. It uses vacuum. No idea how it uses vacuum, but it uses vacuum. It heats up the water and then keeps it hot. So that's the way it works. It doesn't keep heating up like a kettle. I absolutely love my cooker. If you're having a new kitchen, or you're thinking, well, what could I do, you know, in my kitchen, get one of these, because they are absolutely brilliant. Welcome to the award-winning Dear Lovejoy podcast, and it's a special. Woo-hoo. Today's guest, he's one of life's good guys. He's so much fun to hang out with. He's Tom Kerridge. He's a chef, a 3 Michelin star chef, 2 on Hand of Flour, which is a pub which you've been to, Mark.
I have, and it's astonishing. Yeah, it's
first pub to get 2 Michelin stars.
They were both deserved. I think I ate both of them.
The food was fantastic, was it? He's such a lovely guy.
Yes.
In this interview, we learn a lot. He just tells you a lot about the industry and all the chefs and the rock and rollness of it all and everything else. I think you're absolutely going to thoroughly enjoy this. And all the way through it, and I know, don't listen to this if you're too hungry.
If you're fancying your pint.
If you like beer, because he does talk about food and he talks about alcohol as well. And you do think, oh God, I'd really like something to eat now. Anyway, this is him from my kitchen, Tom Kerridge.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Tom, welcome to my kitchen. Thank you for coming here today. All my guests, I buy a present. I've actually repeated myself here, but I think it's for a good reason. This is the same gift that I gave Alistair Campbell. And Alistair Campbell's a really busy guy. And I think you're a busy person. You do a lot of work and you've got a lot of restaurants.
Yeah.
And you know, with your restaurants, your TV work and everything else. So this is Haemin Sunim. He's a Buddhist monk from South Korea. And this is like my Bible. I read this whenever it's called The Things You Can See Only When You Slow Down. It's a brilliant gift to buy people. And if I don't say so myself, but but it's got some really lovely things in there. I'll just read one of them to you. It's basically just little bits on each page. Are you moving up? Are you doing well? Then see whether you are succeeding at the expense of others or along with others. If you shove others aside on the way to success, then you'll be pulled under once the tide changes. I think that's very valid. So it's just loads of lovely little things. It's kind of like my Bible.
Very kind thing. Thank you very much.
Well, take some time out just to read a couple of them every now and then, because I read it all the time. And whenever I'm feeling slightly agitated, I I listen to what Heyman Suman says and he calms me down. So I was, because most of the guests I buy wine or food, but there's no point in buying you food or wine because you get it all for free, don't you?
Well, no, I still have to buy it, but I can get it at wholesale prices. It's slightly different. I don't get an awful lot for free, but every now and then you get sent stuff, which is nice. I mean, you must get the same. People send you things.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Whether it's music tracks or bits and bobs, you know, all those
cookbooks.
Sort of, or cookbooks. Cookbooks. I mean, I don't know if this has been mentioned before in this kitchen, but I just want to say that Tim's cookbook collection is incredible. It looks amazing and beautiful, and it looks amazing and beautiful because the collection of cookbooks that Tim has in his kitchen, he has them on the shelves due to the color of the sleeve, not actually to the content of the book. So his cookbook collection looks amazing.
It's true. it's what I do. It's how I select them. On the way out, I was talking to Mark on as you were coming in. I went, oh, I wonder if Tom's book's up there. And Tom's table is up there behind me. And it's a nice, because it's kind of, what colour would you say?
I would say it's a creamy kind of creamy, off-grey colour.
Yeah, and it's nice.
Suits the kitchen very well.
But I've got pink ones and yellow ones. I never read any of them, but they look beautiful. They're a nice little collection of vibrant colours there. But if I'm looking for a recipe, genuinely, this is what I do. The first thing I do is I think, has Simon cooked it?
Yeah.
And if Simon's cooked it, I think I'll look it up and try and find that. Or if I'm trying to think of something, I just go online. I think a lot of people do that, don't they?
Yeah.
And then I look for my favourite chefs online. Do you put a lot of your recipes online?
Well, to be honest, they go online after they've appeared on TV through the BBC website. I don't do a lot of online recipes. It's not. I've not branched out into posting everything online in terms of recipe content. If it comes through the TV shows, they do often go online in conjunction with the show.
Yeah.
But like you say, people do genuinely just Google chicken breast curry sauce and see what comes up. Although if you have got a good mate like Simon Rimmer, then you know that's not a bad place to start, to be honest with you. I mean, Simon's knowledge of food is phenomenal. You know, it is, especially on accessible cookery. If you think of the show that you'd go to do every Sunday, I mean, the amount of recipes that Simon has to come up with, and he's constantly driving and thinking of great things for people to actually cook at home, not just chef stuff.
Yeah.
Things that people want to do, and that's really important.
And there's a difference between what you can do in a commercial kitchen and what you're going to be bothered to do at home, isn't it?
Yeah, hugely. You know, commercial kitchens are, you know, you have the Hand of Flowers, we've got, I don't know, 15 chefs on a service. No one's got 15 chefs at home, have they? I mean, Simon might have, but everybody else, you know, when you come in from work, we've all got busy lives. So when you come in, you want to open the fridge, see what's in there, stuff that you can stick in a pan, get it done in half an hour and sit down and eat it. Every now and then you aim to do something a bit longer for the weekend if you enjoy cooking.
Yeah.
And that's where the recipes for home cooking come in. As long as there's a bit of technique in there and drives flavour forward, it's a very different skill set that writing books and doing recipes for the home cook rather than just on a professional basis.
Simon made me buy that cooker when I did the kitchen out because he said, you'll have fun with that. And it's true. I do have fun. My cooker's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a lovely semi-professional stove, I'd say that is. And it does make a difference. I think if you enjoy doing stuff, and it's not just food and cooking at home, it must be the same as like, I've got no idea about it, but DIY, if you enjoy doing that, if you've got like a really good drill and a super hammer and a really buy yourself the proper nails and screws and bolts and stuff, it must feel better putting it together. And that's the same sort of thing as cooking and being in a kitchen. You know, if you've got really nice kit, it works better. You enjoy using it more.
Simon once said to me, and you didn't tell me whether this is true as well, he said, when you get a nice cooker like that, you've got a better range of heat. Whereas a lot of the cookers, which, because my mates were laughing at me when I said I was getting this.
Yeah.
I did get quite a nice discount on it. It's a Wolf one, by the way. It's fantastic. It's beautiful. But he says you get sometimes on the lesser cookers it's hot or off.
Yeah.
That's basically, and chefs like a range and they like it to react quickly, is that right?
Yeah, exactly that. You do need a range. You do need to be able to control. That's the main thing. Being able to control it, because you know, and the next thing that comes from that is if you've got the control, that's amazing. But you then also need to invest in pans. You know, pans that conduct heat evenly and correctly, and it's always getting quite anal, but to the point, it really does make a difference when you're cooking things at home. Even just something like a simple risotto on a controlled heat with a pan that has even conduction, suddenly all the rice starts cooking at the same time, everything, you're stirring it feels, the bubbles are nice, and all of a sudden you start enjoying cooking a risotto and the end result will be better.
Jeremy Pang, do you know Jeremy Pang?
He's
the food he does on our show, it works so well because it's simple, it's easy, it's so tasty. He does the Chinese food, and he said to me once on the show, I said, I bought a wok, and he goes, what's it like? And I went, yeah, I'm not sure how it's working. He goes, you want thin and cheap because you want the heat to go in really quickly and to come out really quickly. And he goes, that's how you cook. So thin and cheap with the wok. And I've always say it on the show. And one, the last time he said, stop saying that because I'm trying to sell them now. I don't want to sell the cheap ones anymore. Yeah. I want to sell them. But it's funny because that style of cooking, they want to get the heat in the food really quickly.
Yeah.
And as someone like me who knows, I know now enough about cooking, I've been doing it for 10 years with Simon, 11 years, you suddenly see that the range of heat and how you get the heat in the food really is important for you guys. And because we just go and eat the food. If you go to like a Chinese style restaurant or a Thai restaurant or something, for them, all the food is in the preparation, all the cooking's in the preparation, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, like every restaurant, to be honest, it's all about the prep work. People say when, you know, you're a chef, why are you starting at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning when lunch doesn't start till 12? Well, it's all the prep work. And that all that prep work means that when lunch service comes or dinner service comes and you're doing 70, 80 people, it you can turn it around quickly because you've got vegetables chopped. You've got things prepped in advance. You've got all stuff ready to go. And it's so much of making your life easier. It's the same when you cook at home. If you've got so many people when they come to looking at cookbooks and they do a recipe thing, oh, that sounds nice, and they start cooking as they're reading the recipe as they're going along, and then it says and marinade for 24 hours and you're like, don't you know, you've got to read the recipe and that understanding of getting things prepped. If it says dice onions, right, well, you could dice them, put them in the fridge, dice peppers, put them in the fridge, like you work it all out, and then when it just comes to throwing it all together, it makes it so much easier.
When I did MasterChef, I worked in a Thai restaurant. That was one of the things they did. They first of all made me work in the ambulance service. That was such hard work, making dinner for them. I had to make spaghetti bolognese for them all. And then I had to work in a Thai restaurant. And I hated every minute of it, I've got to tell you. I don't know how you guys do it. It's so hot.
It is, yeah.
And it's like, there's no pace to the day.
No.
It's like, just like, service is here, right, you're on it full time now.
Yeah, yeah.
Fat spitting up your arm, you're getting burns everywhere, you're boiling hot, you're sweating. And then at the end, they're like, do you enjoy it? I'm like, no, that was horrible.
I think if the most successful chefs and the most successful restaurateurs are the one that actually enjoy that.
Yeah,
you know, that buzz, that adrenaline kick that you get from it, it's amazing. But it is a fine line between, wow, there's this big, you know, with that pleasure and pain thing where you get this is so painful, so, and then when you've finally done it, you go, wow, what a joy and elation kind of thing comes over you. But and you get that twice a day for lunch and dinner. But there are some times where it just feels like, it's pain. This is painful. This is horrible.
Do you know what? I was all right because I was confident. This sounds bad, but I didn't care enough. Like when I was a waiter, I was never nervous because it was like, you know, I'm making someone's dinner here. They're not going to kill me if I mess up. Some people walk into a kitchen and they're so nervous.
Yeah.
And we have it on the show on Sunday brunch where people are in the kitchen. They're like, don't get me to do anything. I can't do anything. Why do you think cooking conjures up that nerve thing for people?
I don't know. I think because maybe people don't... aren't used to doing it. And like you say, it's a confidence thing. Like you've been watching and being involved with Simon for 11 years. You've seen people around food and you see that it's not the be all and end all. And making things, you know, you recognise that if you buy nice ingredients, at the end of the day, they are still going to taste quite nice. Even if you mess them up a bit in the oven or they overcook or they're undercooked, a nice ingredient is still going to be a nice ingredient. It tastes nice. And you have to put a lot more respect or an understanding in the ingredient and the cooking process. And I think if people don't do that a lot at home and they haven't got the confidence to do it, or they can't be bothered with the time scale of it, like it's a lot easier to just have a pre-packed meal or, you know, some sort of ready meal from the supermarket and that's all they do, they don't enjoy it, then when you ask them to do something, it's completely out of their comfort zone and that makes them nervous. And then I suppose throwing it into live TV, then they're going to feel massively exposed, aren't they?
But I saw a lot of people at the moment want to be chefs. It became really rock and roll, what, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 15
well, yeah,
years
20,
ago?
20, 25 years ago, Marco Pierre White's cookbook, that was the turning point. So it was all those amazing cookbooks you got behind you, they never used to look like that. They were always... they're always like textbook style. It was always like almost French cooking. You have La Russe Gastronomique behind you, which is one of the first and most amazing cookery books with all the recipes from Escoffier in it. So they are classic, incredible French. There's dishes in there that like take one whole chicken stuffed with 30 truffles. It's like those are the sort of dishes that, you know, no one ever cooks. they're amazing dishes. They taste fantastic. But that's what food used to be.
But Tom, that book's black, so I'm not sure how long it's going to last.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't sit right next to the yellow and the pink books, I've got to be honest. But the idea of it, though, that is quite textbook and quite classic, and that's quite daunting. It's almost like, if you don't enjoy cooking, that's like reading a book on, I don't know, physics, or a book on history, or on, if it's not your thing, then there's no enjoyment about it. And then all of a sudden, Marco Pierre White's cookbook, White Heat, came along, and it was, all the photographs were taken by a fashion photographer called Bob Carlos Clark, and it showed this kitchen being rock and roll and loads of energy and buzz, and there was a bloke there with scraggly hair who was smoking cigarettes with a butcher's apron on, and you know, there was fire, and then there was, you know, pictures of two chefs having a play fight, and it just felt like there was it suddenly set it alight, and there was vibrancy, there was so much energy coming from this book. And then the back pages, the second half of the book, were pictures of the food, which are almost like timeless classics. So you've got these wonderful, beautiful colour photography pictures of the book, of the food, which is like really engaging and beautiful. And then the front half of it, all these black and white pictures of this high energy, high octane, kind of like, I suppose, rock and roll, punk rock style pictures that were coming from, that looked like it could have been taken from a rock band, of people stage diving or all this sort of stuff. But it was a kitchen. It was a small kitchen in Wandsworth. And you go, this is cool.
Did it sell well?
It sold massively within industry. It sold quite big within, for people at home to have one of the, it was a coffee table cookbook. Cause it was like, you know, it showed this energy of this cool guy. And he was the first, he was the first British chef to win 3 Michelin stars, and he had a reputation for throwing customers out of the restaurant. He had a reputation for being rude. He had a reputation for being, you know, like, and it was proper rock and roll. And this is before Twitter or Instagram or anything like that. So this reputation had been built through the press, who were writing stories, and that would take 4 or 5 days before you'd even read them. So it wasn't instant like that. So this reputation became even more solid because, you know, the written word in newspapers 25 years ago was pretty much seen as standard, and it was very hard to alter that. Now, you know, with Twitter and Instagram, you can change things, you can change opinions in an instant. Whereas, you know, he worked very hard to create this kind of elusive image. He didn't do very many interviews. You know, he built this kind of reputation of being this rock and roll chef with this high energy. And he was, you know, he's one of the younger, he was the youngest chef at 31 to win 3 Michelin stars. And so, you just go, phew.
No, I don't want to be sexist here, but it then did attract a massive amount of young men into the industry, didn't it? Who were like, this is exciting. It's we're making something, it's creative. There's an award at the end of it, which men like. Yeah. You know, I know there's lots of women have come into it now, but at that time, lots of men, there's an award if you can get there, and there's swearing, and there's heat, there's food, there's alcohol.
Yeah.
And apparently the party lifestyle back then was quite immense, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, chefs have got that reputation industry-wide of being rock and roll people. They go, you know, my days are long gone, but, you know, you used to go out at 12:30 at night and then stay out until 3 or 4 and then back in the kitchen by 7 a.m. So, you know, you might survive on 3 or 4 hours sleep a night while still partying, while still then doing 16, 18-hour days in a basement kitchen, you know, working hard, thriving on this energy, this adrenaline buzz and loads of caffeine and loads of energy throughout the day, and then loads of booze in the night, and then, you know, waking up and feeling, you know, you'd feel, I mean, we all know what a hangover feels like, but it would be an extreme hangover. But the next day at work, because the energy level would always be so high, that vibrant, it would take you on this roller coaster ride of ups and downs and ups and downs. And it's a one, like, if it suits you, there's loads of different industries where you can get that from. But the one thing about being a chef is, it doesn't matter your background, it doesn't matter qualifications, it doesn't matter where you're from, it doesn't matter whether you can read or write, it doesn't matter, you know, you're all there for the same collective reason, that you enjoy being in that space. So it attracted all sorts of people, and it showed that you could be successful no matter your background, no matter where.
So could you start by just doing the washing up?
Yeah, that's how I started. I started off by going into a kitchen, washing up. And what happens then is I fell in love with the industry. Like so many chefs my age, it isn't about the background of where you come from and learning how to make an apple pie with your grandma. It actually comes from the energy level that you get from being in a kitchen, in a space. Go, this is rock and roll. I love it.
So all those catering colleges, pointless?
No, they're great. So when I went to catering college and worked full time.
Right.
Now catering colleges, the point, they're called catering colleges. Now catering is everything. Right. You know, catering covers, you know, learning how to pick up a knife, learning basic food hygiene, learning stock rotation in fridges. And every, you know, if you work, everyone just associates chefs as being seen as the rock and roll Michelin star ones. But actually, you know, the guys that serve food in hospitals, the guys that serve food at airports, the people that do stuff for school dinners, they've all got to learn and all learn. We all base our basic skill is exactly the same. Sell by dates on food and understanding of food hygiene, how things are cooked, pricing and budget, and they all vary. I mean, they can all be different, you know, it doesn't matter. We all have the same things. If you're selling a main course for 45 quid, there's a cost element that comes into it. But if you've got a budget of £1.20 a day, like some people in hospitals, they still have that budget. And catering colleges do teach that.
That's good,
so it doesn't matter on the level. There is an understanding that comes from catering colleges. They are really important.
When I did the ambulance service, there was this brilliant woman helping us. She was amazing. I got hats off to her. Fantastic.
What was their budget?
Very little, very I imagine. Little, yeah. Very little. But I chopped the ends off the carrots. And she went, what are you doing? And I went, and I was putting them to one side to bin. You know, like you do.
Yeah, yeah.
She was like, no, they're going in. We need the margins.
Yeah,
they're going
in. Yeah.
And then it looked a bit grey. You know, the one at home you make, you're going to put some Worcester sauce in it or something. You're going to make it look colourful. And ours looked very grey. And she got out this stuff, which was gravy browning.
Yeah, gravy browning. Blackjack, I think it used to be so called.
And she goes, just add a bit of this. It just makes it look, you know, better on the eye. And I was sitting there thinking, well, I don't know what's in that stuff. it did taste all right, though. But she was talking about the margins all the time. They're trying to make food. And they're trying to keep the prices down for the ambulance service or whoever's there and stuff. So, but what a job making that much food for everybody.
Unbelievable. Oh. And that's where catering colleges are great, because they try to tick so many boxes for people. And, you know, we all forget that. But, you know, if you're visiting somebody in hospital, a relative in hospital, they are getting free meals a day. And yes, hospital food gets a hard time, and it is, you know, not necessarily the most nutritious and most beautiful looking food, but it does exist, and you're not paying for it. And it's how you make those margins and how you get them out there. Yes, everyone can look at improvements, but at the same point, you've got to have an understanding of how to get there.
Yeah. It must be a lot of chefs who burn out, though. You must see a lot come into the industry, think this is rock and roll and fun, and then after a while they just get themselves burnt out.
Yeah, it is one of those industries that is always seen as a young person's kind of game. You know, it's a little bit, I mean, the parallels are quite similar, I suppose, to a sportsman or footballer. As you look at it and you come through and you're young, 17, 18 year old, and you might break through into the main team, and you have to work really hard to get through that. And then you can have all the way through into your mid and early 30s. But if you're a footballer that's 32 years old, you are now the senior member of the team. You know, you are the person that has got the experience, and that's most definitely at a sous chef level, if not head chef level. You're the captain, you're a leader on that team as a 32, 33 year old, and you understand where things have come from. You might have won a Premier League, you might have won a Champions League, you might have done something really, you know, being a part of that journey. And then you need to look at how you then slowly move yourself away from being there, you know, 70 hours a week working on the pass, putting the veg away. You need to look at management structure and understanding of how you can make that kitchen move around you. So it kind of works into, you know, like Michael Carrick becoming a trainer now, becoming part of the coaching staff, and then and then he'll look at becoming a manager. And slowly it is very similar, so that by the time you're in your mid 40s, you are looking at a much more understanding of the structure of the business rather than necessarily being at the rock face.
Yeah. Is there a lot of rivalry between the chefs? There used to be.
Used to be huge.
But you lot seem to like each other now. But years ago, there was, like, I mean, the Ramsays and the Marco Pierre Whites and stuff, they were always at each other, weren't they, all the time?
Yeah, huge. Well, Gordon used to work for Marco. Gordon was Marco's sous chef and head chef for ages. And then they separated and went different ways. And then they've fallen out with each other. And now I think they might be mates again. I don't really know. But there was that whole period in the 90s where people didn't talk to each other. And every kitchen was very, particularly, I mean, a London-centric kitchens where there was, you know, lots of rivalry between lots of people. But that's kind of, over the years, that's the last 15 years, that's most definitely changed. Whereas chefs, we're all in the industry together. We all recognise that there's maybe a shortage of staff. So you kind of network with each other. It starts off as a networking point of view where you want chefs. If one of my chefs wants to move, he's been with me for 18 months, 2 years, and fancies going somewhere else, rather than somebody have to pay like a recruitment the consultancy fee. You say, well, where do you want to go? Who do you want to go and cook for? Where do you want to go and learn? And then so you make that phone call, ring that chef up and go, listen, I've got a great guy, been with me for 2 years. They haven't got to pay an agency fee. That guy gets a trial or pretty much gets the job because of your recommendation. So it works very naturally. And then after that, you know, we all, you know, you meet at awards, do. It must be the same in media and broadcasting things. Yeah. You all know each other. Do you know what I mean? You all get on. You all, you know, there's a little bit of needle maybe between some people that don't like each other, but in general, you're all in it together. And that the hospitality industry has very much grown to being a big family now rather than being rivals.
Shortage of staff.
Yeah, big shortage of chefs.
Well, how's that? Everyone wants to do your job, I thought.
Yeah, but I think there's more restaurants. So it always used to, there's never been enough chefs. There's never, when I first started, there was always a chef shortage because of hours. And there were maybe, I don't know, there were five or six real top restaurants. And you look at Raymond Blanc's place and you look at the Rue Brothers and you look at, and they were incredible. And I first wrote a letter to the Manoir when I was 18 years old asking Raymond Blanc for a job. And I was told that there's an 18-month waiting list to get in. And you think, oh my God, if you wrote to the Manoir now and wanted a job, you'd be in. You know, because there is that shortage of chefs because there's more restaurants. So more people want to get into the industry,
yeah.
But there's more restaurants. So there's always these spaces that we've got to fill. You know, it's an incredibly creative, fantastic industry. And we also come from an age now where chefs can move and move quite quickly. And because of the internet and because of an Instagram age for chefs is great. And it used to be quite isolated that we look at great restaurants that are in the UK or just in London. And now young chefs are in my kitchen and looking on their Instagram feed on a break this afternoon. And they're looking at what chefs are doing in Brazil. Look at what chefs are doing in Tokyo, in Hong Kong, in wherever else. And it's amazing. And it's the world of cooking has suddenly become much, much smaller.
Were the best restaurants always in London years ago then? Because now they're all over the country, aren't they? You get Michelin stars all over.
No, not always. Marco Pierre White trained up north first in Yorkshire, and then headed to London. I mean, I think the Gavroche was the opening point of everyone. It was the first three Michelin star restaurant in the UK, and without the Rue Brothers,
I've been there, and they I didn't have a jacket.
Oh, did they make you wear a jacket?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they got a jacket out, which was a couple of sizes too big. So I
did it feel like it was your first day at school with a blazer that your mum had given you that you grow into?
I was so shocked that they said you gotta wear a jacket. Yeah, it was exactly like that. So I went it to is, the, I went
but
to the
that's
toilet.
What it was like
so
when it opened in 1967.
Yeah.
So it's still the same those ethics and that kind of what that restaurant stands for is amazing. It is, you know, it's built on great foundations of phenomenal French cooking. And it's not modern and it's not cutting edge, but what it is steeped in history. And the most beautiful restaurant.
So I remember what I had because it was so lovely. I had beef shin.
Yeah.
I'll have that because I've never heard of it before. You know, like who eats a shin of a beef?
Yeah.
And it just, the meat just fell off it. It'd been cooking for, I don't know, a week or something, you know, the usual sort of stuff. And it was absolutely incredible. Yeah. So I remember it very vividly that I was just going, wow, what a meal.
But that's that understanding of beautiful cookery and braising. And that's where that stems from. And then what's happened is there's kind of like this family tree that steps like a big kind of like triangle pyramid thing that the Rue brothers are at the top. And then from that underneath them, Marco Pierre White trained and Pierre Kaufman worked for them. And then there was the Tonclair and then Raymond Blanc set up the Manoir. And then underneath them, you've got Gordon Ramsay. And underneath Gordon Ramsay, you've got Marcus Waring. And then it kind of this pyramid filters out. And so there's become more and more chefs that they're the pinnacle point and they're the starting point. And after that, so there's all of these great cooks that are then opening more and more restaurants that you're still trying to get. You know, you're still trying to, the restaurants have to be busy to survive, but you also need the young chefs to be into wanting to cook.
So where do you fit in that tree, that family tree?
I come quite down, further down the line. I suppose my biggest influences were British chefs. So I worked for a guy called Stephen Ball, who was one of the first chefs to win a Michelin star, and Gary Rhodes. So they're much further down the line. So Gary worked on, Gary won a Michelin star at the Greenhouse where he was in Mayfair, and he was doing steamed suet puddings, and he was doing bread and butter pudding is one of his most famous dishes, and won a Michelin star doing classic British cooking. And that, using kind of a bit of French technique, but they were rock solid, amazing, amazing dishes. And they were all about taking all the faff away. So it might be two or three things on a plate and that's it, taking things away. And he cooked with such a confidence. So I come from an understanding of, and Stephen Ball was exactly the same. So I come from an understanding of British flavours with French cooking, I suppose.
You absolutely love it, don't you?
Oh, it's my life, you know.
You know, it's so interesting because you're telling us all about the fact. I bet you there's a lot of chefs out there who are good, who don't know the depth you know of this. It's like the time I met Andy Murray. The first time I met Andy Murray, before he'd won all these things years ago, he just kept telling me about percentages of Federer's backhand and this and that. He knew so much,
yeah,
rankings and everything, because he was just obsessed with it. And then, yeah, when everyone started saying to him, by the way, I'm not saying you're like Andy Murray at all.
I'm not very good at percentages.
I do like Andy, but when Andy started winning and people going, oh, God, he's a bit miserable, you're like, no, Andy is not miserable. He's obsessed with, yeah, winning and his industry and what he's doing, you know.
Yeah.
And seems that very similar to how you've obviously found it as a passion and gone, I want to know everything.
Do you
about
know what,
it.
Tim? I was one of the luckiest men around. That I, as an 18-year-old, I walked into a kitchen and I recognised that this is where I want to be. And it wasn't about food; it's about the industry. And like you say, you know so much about the history of people. It's not just about the food. Like, the food comes almost secondary to the industry. It's that I fell in love with. And, you know, to walk into a space of a job that, it's not even a job, you know. It's never been about money. It's about finding a place in life where you're very happy. I've never had a Monday morning feeling. Listen, we've all had shit days at work. Like, yeah, we've all had times when we go, oh God, this is horrible. But there's people out there that week in, week out, go to bed on a Sunday night going, oh God, I've got work tomorrow. And that's, I mean, they're working and then come home and go, God, thank God that's over. I've never had that. I love going to work. I love being around food and the industry and the people. And that makes me very lucky. And there are people out there that have found their way in life and where they want to be. But, you know, I've been very lucky from the age of 18 that I've just gone, wow, this is such a cool industry and space to be in. And, if that makes you slightly Andy Murray obsessive about it, then I'm quite happy with that.
But I always knew Andy Murray was going to be successful because you could see in his eyes that he just absolutely loved it. I became sort of similar with TV years ago. I fell in love with the idea of doing it. And
yeah.
So, you know, I wasn't the best, but I knew that I wanted to do it, so I didn't give up. And that was kind of how it went. How hard, though, is it to have a relationship if you're a chef?
So there's many a story of chefs having broken marriages, falling in and out of love with different people, working different hours, because your other half, the person that you fall in love with and the person that you want to be with, has to have a recognition of what you do, that Saturday nights then aren't for going to cinemas and going out.
They're going to have to realise that they're not going to see you.
Which in some ways makes for an amazing marriage. But you have to have the full support of the other person. And I was also very lucky that I met somebody who has their own career path. So it works hand in hand alongside each other, so that we can have conversations on a, you know, that aren't about my work. It's not just obsessive. You know, what she does is, my wife Beth, she's an artist. So, you know, and her career over the last 5 or 6 years has really rocketed. So, you know, it's wonderful to have, and we're both supportive in each other's careers and career paths and an understanding of where we're going. And it's, you know, you have to be very lucky to find somebody who just doesn't become the other half of, you know, married to the chef. You need somebody to be able to have their own life and also recognize, but then also as a chef, you also have to give back to that, because quite a lot of chefs on their days off will be like, I've worked 90 hours this week, I'm going to sit on my day off, I'm having a lie-in till lunchtime, and then I'm going to do me washing, and then I'm going to go to the pub, get drunk, and go back to bed. Well, actually, if you're in a relationship with someone, those are the days on your days off. You've got to give them that. You've got to get up at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning and decide to go and do something with the day. You have to, if they're committing time to you on the time when you're not at work, you've got to commit it to them, because otherwise it's just a one-way street, and that's no good for like any relationship, irrespective of whether you're a chef.
Yeah. That noise in the background, by the way, is my cat. I never see her. All day long, she just ignores me. As soon as I start a podcast, she's down here, and she's really vocal always. So that's her meowing in the background. You've attracted her down, Tom.
I know. Hello, mate. Must be the smell of food on my trainers.
Exactly. Exactly. But when you can you ever switch off, though? So when you go on holiday, say, for instance, sorry, it's really hot in here, by the way.
Right.
But I thought I'd make it hot for you. You know,
yeah, make me feel at home.
Yeah, there you go. I got some white steam. No, so when you go on holiday, are you ever able to switch off? Or are you looking, going, hold on, we're in Barcelona, we need to check out this restaurant? And then when you're there, you're thinking, oh, I know what I could do with this food.
Yeah.
Do you ever manage to just go and switch off totally?
No, not really. But at the same point, it's great because it is my life. It's like, you know, you choose to go on holiday somewhere where there's great food. I mean, doesn't everyone want to go on holiday where there's great food? You know, that's it. You know, and if you just have a bit more about where you're going, you go and eat great food. It's brilliant, isn't it? It adds to your holiday. So yes, you know, it's nice to be able to go and visit places, eat lovely stuff and know where you're at. that's always a good thing, but no, you're never switched off from it.
Do you ever get a chance to just like watch Netflix, go through a box set or something?
No, I haven't done a box set in ages. The last thing I saw was probably about 4 or 5 years ago, and that was Breaking Bad, and that was the last box set. Every now and then, now that I've got a son, I try to make sure that I get Sundays off. So, you know, having a little man is quite a big thing for me, and that commitment to. Again, it goes back to an age thing where you can try and make it more of a management thing, so I can try and structure my week so that Sundays I try and keep like sacred, which means that Sunday nights, if he goes to bed, there's always something that we might watch. At the minute is Homeland. So you're going, okay, I'm watching Homeland. That's quite good on a Sunday night. And that's kind of the thing. But that's because that's on a Sunday.
Do you cook at home?
Yeah, I do like to cook on a Sunday. It is something that, you know, I stick something in the oven and look after it, or, you know, but easy things like a shoulder of lamb that you could put in the oven and not stress about. You know, you can leave it in there for 3, 4, 5 hours. It doesn't really matter. It's not going to overcook or burn if you cook it. You know, it's nice. I do like doing that. I like cooking breakfast for him, with him. You know, he's pretty good at doing scrambled eggs. Like, you know, he's 2 and a half and he'll cook scrambled eggs with us. You know, we'll stick together and do it. Doesn't season it enough yet, but I'm that'll come.
Always a problem with kids this seasoning.
He's definitely watching the salt content.
How did you? Yeah, they always do. How did you get involved in the first place? Then what was the moment that made you decide you wanted to go and become a chef?
Well, it was just that point of I went into a kitchen as an 18-year-old looking for I needed money, so it was just kind of like between the ages of 16 and 18. I didn't do an awful lot. I actually did a little bit of TV work as an actor, and it's a long old story, but I was in a youth theatre, and I joined a youth theatre when I was a young kid, because it was kind of something to do rather than.
Where are you from? Where's this?
Gloucester. I'm from Gloucester, right, so okay. I went to a youth theatre in Cheltenham,
right?
Which was full of girls from Cheltenham's Ladies College. So it was kind of like, as a 16-year-old, it was a good place to be.
It's a good idea.
This is quite cool. But I've always been quite comfortable in my own skin. So actually, in being part of a youth theatre was quite good, I think, for a confidence point of view, from just being able to have a conversation with somebody. It lends it to being, I think, helping to build a character. But between the ages of 16 and 18, I did little bits and bobs on TV. Like I was in Miss Marple. I played a borstal boy in Miss Marple. I played a school bully in a couple of like kids TV shows. And now I was in London's Burning, and my official title on that was Thug One. So I was, I was typecast by the age of like 17 and a half. And I just thought, this isn't quite right. So it wasn't my thing. I went into a kitchen looking for a job, and I walked in there, and there was just it comes back to the energy level and the people that were there, the interest, the conversations that were going on, you know. And then there was also like the adrenaline thing. There was like fire, open flames, like your lovely stove when you turn it on, there's you get a little buzz, don't you, as soon as you turn it on? There's fire, it's a little bit of danger, there's sharp knives, there's adrenaline, and I just thought, this is just such a great place. So from about the age of 18, started off washing up, looking for money, and it sucked me in from there.
Yeah, I always say to Simon, I enjoy the chopping, I enjoy the cooking, but I just hate grating. I really can't stand grating, but when you get all the knives and stuff, it's quite good fun, isn't it?
Fun, you know. And you can see why people get quite obsessive with knives as well. You can see, even if you're not a chef, you can get quite obsessive because they do a lovely job. You can get quite obsessed with this is a Japanese knife that's come from some samurai space, that they fold the steel 250 times by hand before, you know. You can get all a real geeky about it.
Talking about Jeremy Pang, which we were earlier, he cooks with a cleaver,
yeah,
so everything thing is watching him do it is really
it's mad, isn't it?
He gave me one, so I try it all the time. But
you still got all your fingers?
Yeah, it's really sharp. It's really good. It's good. It's good fun chopping with, but actually, I find a knife easier because I find it easier to rock with a knife. You know?
Yeah, and I think, and also you've learned from an earlier age.
Yeah.
With a knife, like it's standard. If all of a sudden, like now, see, I know how to chop with a knife. If someone puts a cleaver in my hand, I mean, it's all right for when you're doing big butchery of whole carcasses of animals, but actually, like chopping an onion with a cleaver, it's like alien. So it's kind of, I think both me and you would be in the same boat. We lose fingers.
So where are you at with your restaurants and Michelin stars and everything at the moment? How many have you got? Where are you?
So we got Hand of Flowers, which was the first place we opened, which is 13 years old, and that's got 2 stars. It was the first pub to win 2 stars, and that's huge testament to the amount of people and staff that have been with us and for a long, long time and come on the journey with us. And then we've got The Coach, which is on the same street that we opened, that we opened 3.5 years ago, which won a Michelin star in the last guide, which we're super proud of all the guys there that worked very hard for that. And that's kind of a non-bookable turn up breakfast, lunch and dinner kind of space where there's screens on for the sport, but there's no volume on, but you can still watch. You can still watch the Champions League, or you can still watch the rugby or the cricket or whatever else. And it's kind of like 15, 18 seats around the bar and about 25 seats around the outside. It's very small, but works really nicely in the hub of the town. Then we've got the Butcher's Tap, which is I suppose it's a retail butcher's, but it's also a pub. So during the day, it works as a high street butcher's with my business partner, Andy, who's third generation butcher. So it's great. So it's a proper high street butcher that's built relationships and building relationships with people coming back, you know, every week buying their pound of sausages or, you know, and Andy's coming in, they're going, "Hi, Andy." He's going, "Oh, hello, Mrs. Smith. I've got your pre-order of calves liver," or whatever else, that sort of stuff that's working. And then we're opening later this year, the Corinthia, in the Corinthia Hotel, we're opening a restaurant in there. So that's something that's really, really, really exciting. So, but it all comes
from... Why are you doing that? Why are you doing a London one?
Staff, for me, it comes through organic growth of staff. So we're very good at maintaining staff that come on the journey with us. Once they've been with us for a year or two, they normally don't leave and they grow. And we've got to this management level where it kind of hit a ceiling because people have been with us for so long. So the only way that they're either going to go somewhere else, or for them to move up, we need to move sideways and open another space. So it kind of, it's rolling out like that. So it's people that buy into the guys that have been with me for so long treat the business like their own, you know, and that's a wonderful thing, that they're in love with the industry the same, and they have the same care and heart and soul for making everything. That brand ethos comes across, and it comes from them. So it's an opportunity for some great members of staff to open in London. And also from my point of view, I worked in London for 10, 11 years. So the idea of, I don't want to get to 60 and I've had an amazing opportunity to open somewhere in London and be sat there going, "Oh, I wish I'd done that."
Is it different though? Because like you're king of the castle in Marlow, aren't you? You've got your restaurants there, but London, there's a lot of players.
There is a lot of players, and some incredible and amazing restaurants. And it is a very different scene, but it's also a scene that I fully recognise and have been a part of for a long time, not as an owner-operator, but as somebody who's worked here for a lot. And I spend 2 or 3 days a week in London anyway. It's fairly standard. Marlow to here, I mean, on a good run, is 45 minutes.
But what happens when you take on the pressure now? Because you take on that, people are going to expect you to want to get a Michelin star. So... do you have to set yourself a target 5 years or however long you set yourself?
No.
And then if you don't, do you feel you've failed? I mean, how does that work?
Actually, the success is business success. It's not about winning accolades. So accolades has always been... And business success comes from guest and customer satisfaction. And what you aim for is going, okay, we know what we're good at doing. We won't overcomplicate it. We'll keep it very simple. And that's what we'll do in all sites. That's what we do at The Hand and The Coach. We're very good at getting this right. That's what we'll do. And if the guests are happy and they keep coming back, then that makes it a success. And then at the same point, those standards that we impose upon ourselves, if somebody else recognizes that within a guide, then that's great. But that's not the first point of call. Because a Michelin star doesn't make you busy.
Know. Yeah, but you know you would want that, wouldn't you?
The team would want that, of course they would. Yeah, that's what they're aiming for in terms of professional standard.
Right.
But that will come they're good enough. If they're good enough and everyone's ready for it, then it will come. You know, it's not
a Michelin star, I assume, subjective, right? the people, or is there things you have to hit? What? How do?
Nobody
what are,
knows.
What
it's
are they?
It's about. It's about. I think the key to it all is about consistency, and it's about consistency and good produce. And if you look, I mean, we'll talk about it from a London point of view because we're sat here in London. But you've got great Michelin starred tapas places, Italians, Spanish. You've got like phenomenal Japanese sushi restaurants with 1, 2, and 3 stars in London. You know, it's amazing, and that the one thing that all of those restaurants have in common is a consistency and a level of produce that they hit not just once but every single time.
What does produce mean?
Well, produce, you're not buying it, you're not buying cheap, nasty, horrible stuff. You're buying stuff that's got heart and soul. So as a chef,
so they judge you on that, they judge you on what your ingredients are.
You can tell when you eat it, like if you know what you're eating. If you know, come on Tim, you know, you've eaten, if you've bought something cheap from around the corner and you try cooking it, it's nowhere near as nice as the stuff that maybe Simon's gone, here, have a look at this, Tim, take it home and cook this steak. You'll go, wow, it's amazing, there's something incredible. So that understanding that, and that comes from some, that has to come from the beginning part of everything that we do is based on farming and people who look after, you know, how long does it take to grow a carrot? The reality of it is like, it's a long, long time. The understanding, the process, the season, when you sow the seeds, how you look after it, where it goes, how it grows to be, whether it's a real pushed out mass produced carrot or whether it's a loved one that's grown in the right field with the right soil, and all of those things are important.
It's the thing I've learned on Sunday brunch more than anything is ingredients. You can make good ingredients crap, but you can't make bad ingredients good. And you buy a nice piece of meat, you can taste it, and vegetables and everything. The better the ingredients, the nicer your food.
Yeah, and then what you want to do is look at the simplest way of cooking
it.
You just go, you let the ingredient speak for itself. If it's about roasting it correctly, and that makes the best roast chicken with a lovely crispy skin and the flavour come alive, then that's all you've got to do.
So is that why you're good? Because you know how to get the best flavours out of them.
Well, yeah, I think it's probably that's because I look at it, and the more I analyse the way that we cook, I think, we're just lazy cooks. We just go, the produce is so good, let's just poach it. You know, that'll do. But I think a lot of the work of a chef and a restaurateur, most of the time, is actually spending time talking to suppliers and producers and farmers and understanding what's coming through and understanding of the seasons and things like that. And they all make a big, big difference rather than just going with whatever you've got. There are great creative chefs out there that can change and alter your perception of food and textural, how things are different. But the reality is that if you've got a beautiful piece of sea bass that's been line caught by a guy in Cornwall, that's brought it in on a day boat that day, gone to market that morning, put on a van and is with you by 12 o'clock that night, that you've got it on the menu the next day for lunch, there is going to be nothing better than a piece of sea bass roasted with a crispy skin side down, served with a very simple butter sauce. And you just, there's enough, it's the sea bass that's the winner there.
I'm hungry.
But you've got it because the sea bass is great, not because, not for any other reason, you know, and that comes from you've got to be speaking to the fish guys, you know, and that's what makes, for us, that's what we focus on. So I think it makes it the easiest way to cook something.
When Michelin come down, do they come down? How does it work? Do they come down? You don't know.
You don't know they're coming. Right. Like it's completely anonymous.
And do they judge you on atmosphere as well and presentation, or is it just food?
Well, to be honest, I don't really know. Right. I think they say it is just food. It's just food, especially at one star level, because you can get, you know, you've got places. The Coach, for example, is one of Michelin star with non-bookable. It's got Sky Sports on the telly. It's got, you know, you go there and you can have kippers for breakfast, but it is consistent and it's a level. It's the best kippers we can find. It's the best, you know, it's not always the best football, but, you know, but you can get, it's about it being, does it fit? Does the food then fit the ambience and the space in the restaurant that you're trying to create? Do you know what I mean? Does it all tie in together? And those are the things, that's not just key to mission. I think that's key to successful restaurants or even businesses.
It's so important. Yeah. The atmosphere is so important in a restaurant. I've been to restaurants which are regarded really highly, but I'm sitting there going, this is so boring in here.
Yeah.
And the food's great, but you're like, oh, I can't wait to get out and get down the pub or something. Whereas you sit in other restaurants, you go, I don't care what the food's like. I'm having a really good time. And then the food's obviously nice as well.
Yeah, some of the best food experiences you'll have won't be in Michelin-star restaurants. They might be fish and chips on a beach in Brighton on New Year's Day when it's pissing down with rain and you're sat there, but you're going, this is great. And that's what food experiences should be about. And if that all ties in correctly, then you're onto a good thing.
I've always said Michelin stars, though, that it's just the worst award you can get. And I'll tell you why. Because if you win Wimbledon, Tom, you've won Wimbledon forever. You're the 19... 2018 Wimbledon champion. You get a Michelin star.
Yeah.
They can take the bloody thing away from you.
They can.
And then you were the guy who used to have a Michelin star. No one wants to be at the restaurant that used to have a Michelin star. So,
no.
So you've been, you have that pressure then to keep going and keep going. And there has been cases in the past, hasn't there, where people have lost their Michelin stars and gone. I think, didn't someone commit suicide once over that?
Well, that's a, I mean, that's an added on thing. That's a, that people build that together for the great Bernard Lazo, who had 3 stars right. in France and has still got 3 stars.
Okay.
It was slightly different. He was under pressure. I think the story then transpires that he was bipolar and
right,
there was okay. a lot of other issues. But I think those pressures of being a, I think holding Michelin stars is a pressure. But it's only a pressure like, it's an accolade for a business that can help, but it is an accolade that can weigh heavy.
Yeah.
But at the same point, it's the same as most consistent businesses are about. I mean, you say that, you look at, for example, where Arsenal Football Club are about to go into and what Manchester United went into. They used to be the greatest team in the country. Now they're not. They're not picking up some. So it's only the same sort of thing, the same sort of pressures that become their consistent pressures. I know if you, Andy Murray, Wimbledon champion, is great. But if you look at it from a football club's point of view, there's right. only one okay, winner in yeah. the Premier League every year, and yeah. everyone else has had a rubbish season. Do you know
yeah,
what I mean?
They're not giving one Michelin star. They'll give as many as they want, but you've got to keep them.
Yeah, so maintenance.
You can keep it forever. You have to trust, because you can't be in those kitchens for every service. So you've got to trust your staff. That's where that staff thing comes into
staff training is key. That understanding and that building that infrastructure and those foundations that you build as a business, and that's where it becomes where chefs have burnout, because you need to be able to get to being 40, 45 where you're instructing and you're controlling and you're helping people drive forward and be able to create their own dishes or their own personality, but in the mold that suits that restaurant, the space that you've set up. So you're yeah. allowing them to flourish, but at the same point you need them to maintain the standard, and that's where all that skill set starts coming in, and no one can teach you that. That's something that you're learning yeah. as something that I'm learning as I'm going along.
What about the business side of things as well? Did you have to pick that up very yeah. quickly? Because you know, if you're trying to do a unicorn steak or something for a and you're going, the margins on this unicorn steak are pretty, you know, we've got 15 people working on one steak. You know,
yeah.
You've got to try and work out ingredients versus staff versus everything. It's the hardest
industry. It's such a difficult
space.
Should
we put saffron in it? No.
Yeah. yeah. More expensive than gold by yeah. weight, saffron.
No saffron in no any of our dishes, guys.
If you want it looking yellow, let's look at turmeric. Turmeric's very nice. Turmeric's got a wonderful flavour.
Anti-inflammatory, yeah. we're using that. Saffron can do one.
Yeah. But you do learn the business as you go along. It's one of those things that all of a sudden it's not just about cooking, because as a chef you just look at cooking. The moment you open a business you have to run it for yourself. It is about the guest coming through the door, and how do you get the guest to come through the door? So do you then employ a PR company? Do you then pay for advertising in local magazines? How do you justify that when you can't pay the kitchen porter? Or how do you say, well, we've got to go from opening, we've got to open 7 days a week rather than 5 because we need those 2 days of revenue. But then if you open 7 days a week you need more staff, and
yeah.
And they're all really complicated business decisions that you have to make, and you don't always make the right one. But as long as that's where owner operators have an advantage over big corporate companies, is that you can make a decision that morning and it's changed by lunchtime. You can adapt to the situations much more quickly, but you haven't got financial backing, but you can maneuver quickly.
How hard is it to build a team? We had Jodie Kidd on the show the other day, and we were discussing how to employ. That wasn't the show you were on, was it? No,
but I have speak to, was she talking about her pub?
Yeah, and she, yeah. she was trying to employ chefs, and she was trying to, and Simon and myself were discussing the employment, and I always say never employ someone with too many friends.
Yeah.
Try and employ someone who lives miles away from the employer, the pub or whatever, because then they'll be more tied into you. And also don't employ triathletes. I got some stick off that, but basically triathletes spend so much time training that they've got to get out all day.
Yeah.
They've got to do so much training. So they've got to cycle, run and swim. How do you create a team? How hard is it to create that?
I think you have to create with personality. I mean, some of the best, Aaron, who's my head chef at the Hand of Flowers, has been with me for over 10 years and has grown with the business. But Aaron used to work for a mate of mine in a little bistro somewhere with no, you know, the only Michelin star restaurant he worked at was actually at Gordon Ramsay's 3-star place, and he did a day there. That was it. He was like, no, this is way too scary for me. It's not. He went and worked at a little bistro and then came to work with us. And it was, you have to put trust in people and drive them forward with enthusiasm, and that you have to make them believe in you and your journey and where you can take that restaurant. And you slowly build this core of people around you.
But it must be like a football team, isn't it? Because you suddenly get a bad egg in the team and you're under so much stress during service time that you can't afford to have someone who's annoying everyone, can you?
No, you get rid of them. You've got to get rid of them. And if you built a team around you, actually, you don't need to. The team push them out.
Does it?
They get, and that must be that again. That probably comes down to football. You see it all the time when players get ostracized because they don't fit into the dressing room ethos. And the, you know, it doesn't matter how good they are, if they don't fit into the team, then they don't create. They don't help. They don't.
But you're the main chef. Your name's on the door. But your team is. It must be so important for you.
Really, massively important. But you also put infrastructure there. You also give them. You know, there's no such thing as freestyle in our kitchen. Everything has got a recipe and is a standard, and you have to the guys have to do
careful
it.
Not to bang too much, sorry mate, it comes through the speakers.
Don't
worry, go on. You're just
but everything has recipe and standardized, and it is it becomes, there's no freestyling. Nobody can just go off on their own and decide to cook something differently. But we do listen to different opinions. Yeah. If they say, chef, what about, have you looked at the idea of cooking this like this, or what about doing this like this, or trying to bring this flavor into it? Yeah. And they become quite, that's really important. It's a nice, it is accessible for people to be able to have their own space to be creative.
It seemed for a while there was a lot of swearing going on in kitchens. It seems to have turned a corner now that all the chefs say, no, my kitchen's controlled and we don't have a lot of people like each other.
Yeah.
Is that moved on? When you started, was it people going, fucking this, get in number two, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah. And to be honest, the better the place, the less there is that noise. I mean, when you see, if there's a chef shouting and swearing and wanting stuff, that means things have gone wrong.
Yeah.
You know, where it's more controlled, it could still be really fast paced, but it doesn't necessarily, that there has to be communication. So there's always the people on the pass going, away on table 6, 2 beef, 2 duck, 1 chicken, blah, blah, blah. And everyone going, yes, chef. So there's a noise and an energy, but if they're going, where the fuck is this? What's happening with this? Why is that? Like, that means something's gone wrong.
Yeah.
So if something's going wrong, that means that necessarily the standard isn't going to be hit. So the better spaces are much more controlled. There still needs to be communication and noise, and that adds to adrenaline. That makes it exciting.
How long was it before you were famous? Before you became a celebrity chef, as they say?
To be honest, I don't really know. I think it kind of morphed because television was something that's come along since winning Great British Menu. So when I entered Great British Menu 2010, 2009, shown 2010, where I entered it and won the main course. And all of a sudden it becomes TV. I recognized that when I went into the kitchen, it was also a TV studio. And you go, okay, so there's people here making television. They have a job to be, you're part of their job. So it wasn't just about me cooking. So I recognized that if I actually gave back to them what they were wanting, they also left me alone more because they know they could come to you. It would take them 1 minute to get the soundbite that they wanted. They go away again. It's when they're at somebody and you're not giving them what you want, and they're there for 10 minutes. So the more time you give them what you want, quicker you can concentrate on your cooking. So,
but why did you enter it in the first place?
It's exposure for a business. You're an owner operator, and you go, okay, well, this is something that's, you know, 2 million people watch on BBC One or two, and then you go, okay, well, it can showcase what you do as an owner operator, and it wasn't an advert in any way, and it wasn't to get on TV. It was to go, let's see what happens if we do all right. The phone might ring.
Did you want to win?
Yeah, of course I wanted to win. Yeah.
Because you said earlier that you didn't care about the Michelin stars really, but then there is this side of you which seems quite competitive.
Yeah,
at the same
I do like competing. Actually, I like competing against myself. I like pushing myself. And then I thought if I can do the best that I can do, then we'd be all right. I've got a Michelin star. I'm all right at cooking. Let's see how we go with this. So, I wanted to win, but it wasn't the be all. And I wanted to do the best I could. So I pushed myself to make sure. And then the further down the line you get, you start recognizing actually, we could do this. I could win this. This dish is great. I've got to get it. I nail it on. And you go, and you do push yourself to win it. And which was great. And then I came back the second year and I won it again, doing the main course again the second time, which was phenomenal. And then from there, I suppose TV pick people up. It's somebody with a regional accent, which is something that the BBC likes. Somebody,
you're confident, you're comfortable, you're likable, you're funny, people like you. And I think that's half the battle with TV, is people liking you. And
yeah,
when you come on Sunday brunch, you're one of the guys who gets the massive reaction. They're like, brilliant, love Tom Kerridge, he's great. And it's your food's great, but also, yeah, I think because you've got a great personality, people love it, don't they? So
yeah, well, I think
TV came easily to you, didn't it?
To be honest, the one thing that I try to do is just make sure that I'm myself, you know. And the problem with, quite often when you come across two-star chefs, is that their two-star environments is seen as not being accessible. My business has been built on trying to make food accessible.
Yeah.
So making it accessible means that anyone can come in shorts and flip-flops in the summer. I don't care. Come in. We had someone 2 weeks ago sat on a Saturday night wearing a Chelsea football shirt.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I didn't throw them out. You know, it was fine. But it was like, you know, this is great that people, there isn't another two-star restaurant in the country where that guy could have turned up in his football shirt and felt comfy, you know.
It's always us bloody Chelsea fans. Yeah. Ruin everything.
Yeah, but that for me is amazing. I love the fact that somebody felt comfortable enough to do that. And if you can do that and come across like that bloke on the TV, it's fine. Everyone is fine. Just come as you want, and then make it accessible. Then I think, like, if I wasn't a chef, I'd quite happily drive a white van delivering furniture. I'm a normal bloke. I mean, I'd try and make sure that I deliver the finest furniture, and I would make sure that the van is pristine and it's parked correctly. But at the same point, I am that sort of bloke.
How the hell are you juggling though? You know, you've got your restaurants which are successful. You're opening the one up in London, and you've got a TV career. How are you juggling it all?
So staff and team people. I'm a people person, and I like being around people, and I like having enthusiastic people and people that care and people that want to do much. You know, I will encourage people to have a go at stuff, and if there's somebody that we can grow with and invest with, then I'll do that, because it's not about making cash; it's about people. At the end of the day, if you're how many people, you must meet them all the time, Tim. People with loads of cash, but are still pretty miserable. Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
come on the show,
100%, 100%.
And you know how many top rock stars or Hollywood movie stars and people come on the show, and you just think, actually, you know, it should feel like they've got everything, but they feel quite hollow and got nothing. Like, what is it all if it's not about people and enjoying yourself? So if we've surround myself with similar like-minded people, that we're all on this great journey, and that means you go, and it's saying yes to everything. Yeah, let's just do it. Come on, let's just do it. And we'll worry about it as we get closer to it. Sometimes you think, oh my God, I've bitten off more than I can chew here. But then you go, well, that's where you have to dig deep and go, well, let's crack on.
So your TV show at the moment, Top of the Shop, explain that one to us.
Amateur artisan producers that wanted to showcase their stuff, but competing, it is a competition, but it's done for the right reasons. It's about encouragement and enthusiasm rather than it being dark and like negative competition TV. It's about, you know, the art, showcasing people who make things at the bottom of their garden and then want to do it as a full-time job, and their produce is shown in a proper working shop, farm shop up in Yorkshire, and real customers coming through the door and buying their produce and seeing how it stands up against the produce that's already on the shelf. And two judges, one from an incredible restaurateur with a background of how to make business work, and one who's got a phenomenal and outstanding understanding of artisan produce. So they go all the way, they pick the guys that go through to the final, and who's going to win it in the end.
I read an article about this not so long ago, that in this country post-war and probably into the 70s, and stuff, we had very few of those artisan things. And they talked to it in terms of cheese. We had one sort of cheese, big yellow slab of cheddar, rubbish cheddar. Now we've got just so many different types of cheese.
It's unbelievable, the British cheese scene.
And apparently even the big supermarkets pretend their big mass cheeses are artisan. So they give them strange names like Wessex Farm or something. Not that it exists, this farm they're talking about, to make us feel like, because that's what we want. We want that massive industry, isn't it, now? Can people make a living out of it, though?
Well, it's very difficult. But again, I think it comes down to the fact that, yes, they can try and make a living out of it. But the reality is... is it making a living out of it, or is it making a life out of it? And those are the different things that you fall in love with food. And these are people that are trying to do something. They're changing their lives. They're people that have a city job or a something that they do that they're not enjoying. And they're going, their hobby is making cheese or some form of charcuterie or chocolates or marshmallows or whatever it is, or a hot chili sauce and that's what they're in love with. And they go, actually, this, I would love to be able to make a life out of it. If I can make the same sort of money, just break even, pay me mortgage, but just doing something that I want to do. And it's a passion for food that drives them on. And you know, every now and then there'll be a reggae sauce that goes mental, massive, and someone massive, and someone makes loads of money. But the reality of it, and most people in the food scene do it because they love food, and that's it, end of story.
Good. So you're talking about changing people's lives. Good time to talk about your change of life. Five books you've had out.
Yeah.
Have they sold well? Not that you care, because you don't care about competition, but are they?
They have sold well. The last one has been amazing.
The last two have been the last diet two books.
Diet books.
And the last one has been.
Yeah. So the last two. The first one was The Dopamine Diet, which was my own personal story of how I lost shifted a load of timber. And that was through a low carbohydrate diet. So it was loads of low carb recipes and high protein, lots of flavoursome cooking, in the way that is still the way that I eat now. And then the latest one was in conjunction with the TV show. So Lose Weight for Good was taking 13 volunteers that wanted to lose weight in conjunction with the NHS and their website, the 12-week diet plan. And it was all about low calorie food, which is something that at first I thought, well, this is going to be very difficult. And it was very difficult because I wasn't a huge advocate of low calorie food, because every time I'd seen recipes before, I thought, it's no wonder that people yo-yo in and out of diets, because the recipes are so uninspiring. They're flavorless and they're not much fun, and they're always just about, nothing about it makes you fall in love with food. It's just fuel. And you go, okay, so I had to look at it slightly differently and approach it from a chef's point of view and go, how do I make low calorie food taste nice? So all of it was an experiment that we filmed with these 13 people, hoping that the idea is that over a 12-week period, they might lose a stone. So we had 13 people, and I thought, well, if we lose 13 stone between them, we've done all right. But the reality, you go, well, two or three might drop out, three might not do as well. So if we lose 7 or 8 stone out of 13, I'll be really happy. And the reality was, between them all, they lost nearly 19 stone. Brilliant. So it was, for me, it was like, this is amazing. It means that people can eat great food, still enjoy it, and lose weight. And so that book has done very well. And because the people that were in part of the show, people could relate to at home. Again, they could relate to, you know, there were people, a single, you know, stay-at-home dad. There was a, you know, there was a nurse. There was a policeman, there was, you know, they were just people, everyday people with busy lives.
People use food for entertainment purposes, I think. So you get home and you look forward to your meal all day. If it's low calorie, boring and horrible, you're not got anything to look forward to, and so you fall off
the thing.
So if it's tasty and you feel good, like what you've done, then you go, I can still look forward to my meal at the end
and
of the day.
And then you forget even that it's diet food. You're just eating a great meal that tastes great.
So how much did you lose?
Altogether, I've lost the best part of 12 stone.
That's kind of my weight.
That is, I have lost you. I've lost Tim Lovejoy. Has anyone seen Tim?
so wow, that is a lot. What made you want to lose the weight?
Age. I was 39, approaching my 40th birthday, and it came to a point, and I think you recognise that, you go, actually, I need to do something about this. Because you go, like, are you coming to 40? Not far.
He's talking to Mark.
I'm talking to Mark. Mark just went, wow. Yeah, 2 years. So there comes a point where you have a record. One of my best mates described it as, it's halfway to death.
And you go, okay,
I get that. You know, and if you're halfway, well, actually, I ain't gonna get much further if I'm at this point. And it is a point of reflection where you go, what have I achieved? What have I done? How am I going? Where am I going to go in the future? And it made me go, actually, there isn't much of a future unless I do something about it. So that was it.
So did you look at your life and think, I've done really well, I've got all these, you know, really successful, but the one thing I'm struggling here is my weight. Is that
weight and drink, and they were both big things in my life. So you go, I needed to, I mean, the first thing I looked at was when I Googled how to lose weight and what how to do it, I looked up the beer diet to see if it existed. I did think, can I drink 16 pints of ale a day and not eat anything and lose weight? It doesn't exist. It's not there. So that was a crushing blow.
So how much were you drinking then?
Oh, loads. I mean, I was quite happily. I didn't drink during the day, but it was after service. After service and then into the early hours every single day, like every day, and a large amounts lager.
What could you do on a good night?
Oh, mate, I'm well into double figures of lager, and then I start on the gins. Yeah. That's a good night. Like, that's a good night. You know, that wasn't a standard Wednesday. Standard Wednesday might be like 6 or 7 pints and half a bottle of gin. I don't know.
But wow.
It became quite a, it was a big part of my life. Just that. But it's not something that I regret. It's not something that I look back on and go, oh my God. I regret it in the fact that I think I've spoilt it for myself, that I don't drink at all now, and that I know I can't, because that switch would go back on. So I just don't do it. And I go, but I don't regret it in any way, because it goes, when you're driving a business forward, you need a form of release. You need something to let go.
You don't drink at all?
No, teetotal for 5 years now.
That's a huge decision.
Yeah.
Especially in your industry. Huge.
Yeah. Actually, and then people say that and you think, oh yeah, it must be hard. It's not. It's much easier. Easier in my industry, because I now see it as something that I sell to people. It's something that is part of the produce. Like, I don't eat every steak that comes in.
Yeah.
You know, I go, okay, so I've got this amazing produce that is now seen as wine or whiskies or distillation of gin or beautiful, well looked after beers. They're things that we're very proud of, that I view it as something that we sell to guests rather than something that I have to consume.
But how long was that decision process? How long did it take? Was it, you woke up one day and went, that's it, I'm doing it?
No,
or was it over
took
weeks
about three or four months building towards it. So I knew it was coming, and I was working it out, and I was going, okay, so this is the point. And you can always find the excuse, oh, next week is Dave's leaving due, and the week after that is so-and-so's birthday, and then after that is, you can always find it, but there has to be the cut-off point somewhere.
And how do you feel now?
Oh, way better. Yeah. I mean, like, way
better.
Do you
miss it?
Yeah, I miss it. I probably miss it every day, just a little bit. Like, you go, oh yeah, that'd be nice, and then it's gone.
Yeah.
Because I know that I can't enter into that space. And then some days, I won't even think about it for 2 or 3 weeks sometimes. And then
you couldn't just do a pint of beer then?
No, there's no such thing as a pint of beer. If we had a pint of beer right now, Tim, it would end up at, well, it's 3:15 now, it's 12 hours time, we'd be in String Fellows.
I wouldn't, as Mark knows, I'm such a lousy drinker. He got me to drink Old Rosie not so long ago, and I couldn't even see. It's like a cider, 8% cider. Yeah. He was fine.
Yeah.
I couldn't see. It was like so much, but yeah.
No, okay, I'd be in Street Fellows with Mark.
Yeah. You two would be fine. I'd be outside.
We'd have put you in a taxi.
Yeah. Oh dear. When you were putting the weight on, what were you always big, or did you start?
Yeah,
putting...
no, I'd always been I've always been quite a lump from a young kid, but not massively overweight. But I've always been I played a lot of rugby when I was younger.
Wasn't there a stage where it started piling on? Didn't you notice it going on?
Yeah, but it was something that I didn't really pay attention to, because it was like when massively active in kitchens when you're moving and doing stuff, it didn't affect my work. It didn't affect, like, when I was basement kitchens in London, I was still trying to be the fastest, the quickest, the best, the strongest cook that I could be. And then when I set up my own business, you're driving things forward and you're moving things on, and it wasn't getting in the way. I mean, I was still, you know, bending up and down, moving around. I was still physically moving and doing stuff, but at the same point it really didn't affect. But in terms of business wise, we just won 2 Michelin stars. I won Great British Menu Tour. I was doing stuff on TV. I was writing books. Things were all successful, but it was a case of it was just an age. So I couldn't look at the weight having held us back in any way. In any way, it was that was at the pivotal point of us going forward. So that's why I don't look at it as a regret thing, because I see that as something that was an escapism of the driving things forward, if that makes sense.
How long does it take before it started really kicking in, losing a lot of weight for you? Anyone who's listening to this, who's straight away.
Do you know what? the biggest thing. So many people will tell you so many different ways to lose weight. And I thought, you know what? I'm not going to listen to any of them. I'm going to go with my heart, my soul, and my feeling. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go low carbohydrate. I'm not going to weigh myself like every week like people do. I didn't look at the numbers. I just went, you know, I'll just get on it. Do I feel fitter? Yeah. Do I feel better? I suddenly found myself going up and down stairs quicker or doing two steps at a time. Are my clothes getting looser? Am I, like, everything about it, you just start going with how you feel. Because the moment that you get hung up about it and it becomes this big obsessive thing, it starts going back to the food thing. It becomes unenjoyable. And if you're not, there's some people that might need to lose one or two stone, right? And you could, well, they could go through 16, 18 weeks of pain and shit to get to where they want. That's no problem. They can look at the numbers. But if you've got 12 stone to lose, that's not going to happen overnight. You go, actually, this is a journey that I got to go on. So if I'm going to do it, I've got to embrace it. And you go, I'll go with trying to make sure that I enjoy it. That doesn't mean to say that you haven't got to be, you've got to be selfish. You've got to be strong-willed and you've got to be able to not give up. But at the same point, if you become obsessive with the numbers, it doesn't help, because then it feels like a regime rather than a way of life. And it needs to be the way of life for long term.
Change the way, yeah, you've got to change your life. That's the key to it, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, yeah. The way, your outlook to it all.
Yeah. So low carbohydrate is what worked for you.
For me. But the problem with that is, and I do recognize it doesn't work for everyone, because what you're doing is isolating a food group. So you're going, I'm not having it. And for some people that works great. For other people, it's not good at all, because they just don't get on with it. You know, we've been brought up for years that our breakfast is cereal and toast.
Yeah.
You know, well, if that's three meals a day, that's the first one gone. You go, well, how do I get out of that? What do I do? You know, you can't have omelets every morning for breakfast.
I still eat bread, but I cut down massively on bread because it just seemed that everyone was saying it. and then it was, Simon always laughs at this, because it was when I was told by Bill Oddie that I couldn't feed ducks bread anymore. And I'm like, if the ducks can't even eat the bloody stuff, I'm not eating it.
Yeah.
So Simon calls it the duck diet that I'm on, which is, I do eat. So I love a burger. So I'll eat burger with bread and I'll eat all that sort of stuff. So I do it, but I cut down massively. And you're right, in the morning it was always toast or bagels or something like that.
Because it's quick and it's easy and it's what you do. And so if you're trying to isolate a food group, that makes it quite difficult. So I do recognise that it doesn't work for everybody, but it is the one that worked for me.
And has it changed you in other ways? Like, have you noticed mentally you're different and things like that?
In positive outlook, in the ability to actually physically get crack on and do stuff. Yeah.
And do you exercise?
Yeah. Every day.
And what are you doing?
I do 3 2-hour sessions a week in the gym with a personal trainer. And then if I'm not in the gym, I swim a kilometer as quickly as I can. So I'll always do something. And that's not, The gym has become slightly obsessive, where I talk about not getting obsessed with numbers. I've now become obsessed with like trying to build on weights and trying to get personal bests and trying to do, but they're always good because they're actually, that's a point of you're recognizing you're getting fitter. And that's where exercise does come in. Exercise isn't going to make you lose weight, but exercise will help the motivation to lose weight with a diet. So if you swim a kilometer and it takes, I don't know, 30 minutes, but you know, and you start losing weight and 3 months down the line, it's taking you 28 minutes. Then all of a sudden you recognize that you've got better at something. Yeah. There's no other reason for that apart from you've lost weight and you're healthier.
If you want to lose weight, look at the diet before you look at the exercise. It's always important. The exercise is good, but the diet is where it's what you're eating.
Yeah.
Everyone who comes on my show who's absolutely ripped, by the way, like all those guys with the muscles and everything, and they always go, yeah, you build it in the kitchen. It's not built in the gym. It's built in what you're eating in the kitchen. Yeah. That's how they build their abs and stuff.
Yeah.
And it generally, it's high-protein diets and things.
And that suits, I mean, super bodybuilders and that that's fine. But it's not always deemed as necessarily the healthiest route, and that you kind of understand that, and it's about being healthy in mind as well.
So do you ever do any running on a treadmill or anything?
No, it's not,
because it's really bizarre, because when I used to run with weights on me, and the difference it makes, I'm going to sound fattest here or whatever the expression is, but by just having a few more pounds on you, the difference on everything it makes.
Yeah.
So when you're losing weight in the gym, it must be an amazing experience, that everything just becomes easier and easier and easier.
It does. And actually, the funny thing it's funny you mention that. So we used to do, so I do like on leg day at the gym, and you do calf raises where you drop your legs down and you just push upwards from the calves. Like I've started doing it now with weights strapped onto a belt. So all of a sudden you put a 25 kilo weight on the belt. All of a sudden you start going, my God, and that's 25 kilo. Yeah. Well, I've lost way over that. Imagine trying to do this with 75 kilo. Yeah. No wonder that's my knees are fucked.
Yeah, that's what you're doing. Yeah. Did you ever look up David Goggins?
I did look up David Goggins, and it's funny because he told me, and actually 2 days after you told me about him, one of my head chefs, Nick, who's open in London, head chef in London, he said, yeah, I've come across this book, guy called David Goggins.
Oh, he's my hero.
Fucking mental.
He's here,
I was like, hero. And he told me about it, when he took on marathons and he just ran and ran. I was like, what? Yeah. Like,
we haven't got enough time to explain on this podcast what David Goggins has done, but you get a chance, Goggins, look him up. This guy's immense. The ultra marathons he does.
Unbelievable guy.
He's just, his story's fantastic, isn't it? What?
He was obese,
wasn't he? He was obese, and then he wanted to get in the US Marines, and I don't think he was allowed in because he couldn't do something, and he was scared of water or something, so he went back and he taught himself how to do that, and then he got into ultra marathon. The guy just doesn't give up.
Then he decided to run a marathon, and he came third or something, and it was just like in his first marathon with no training or something. It was just like
the one comment he said, and I'm quoting him here badly because it wasn't this, but if you're comfortable in life, you're not living, was kind of the emphasis of it. You've got to make yourself uncomfortable, and when you're uncomfortable and you're not sure what you're doing and you're living. And I just thought that's kind of a good way of going through life. Make yourself uncomfortable.
It is. So somebody pointed out something very similar to me about comfort zone. If you see it as a circle, and then if you're in that circle the whole time, that's in your comfort zone, that's fine.
Yeah.
But that comfort zone is never going to get bigger unless you step out of that circle, and then all of a sudden that becomes bigger. You know, the circle then becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and you just become more comfortable in loads of different things. And I like that outlook.
Stoicism. That's what it is, isn't it? So, there's questions I ask everybody who comes on this podcast, so I thought I'd ask them for you as well.
Yeah.
What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Just say yes to everything. Just say yes to it all. I mean, that's what I've gone through life doing. I've just said yes to, do you want to do this? Yeah. I mean, what really is the worst thing that can happen? It's not that bad.
You end up in a nightclub and...
you end up with... Yeah, let's do that. Yes. I mean, yeah, but then it's a memory, isn't it? It's a great...
It's a
you know,
story.
Everything is built on... And actually, there's no such real thing as failure because they're all learning curves. They're all things that you can build on. They're all character building. And that's the one thing that I would say that... my mum, I grew up as a single parent family, was really supportive about doing also whatever you want to do, just make sure that you try your hardest at doing it, and that's great and that's amazing, but alongside that I've learned myself that if you say yes to stuff, things happen. And it doesn't matter if it's a bad thing, and even if it's a really bad thing and it goes horribly wrong, you've learned from it, and you know that the next time when that comes along, you know how to deal with it better. You know, if I say yes to this, I know how to avoid it doing that. Yeah. It's just a journey.
You've just written a new question that I'm going to start asking people. What's your best failure?
Okay.
What is your best failure?
My best failure was probably going into business. We're in a small bar round the corner from the Hand of Flowers. It must have been about 10 years ago with business partners, and they didn't have the same outlook on life and the same outlook on how to drive things forward as I did. So it suddenly becomes quite sour and quite bitter that you feel that you're working harder than them and it's not. And you go, okay. So that ended up wrapping up, costing quite a bit of money. And you just go, okay, so we learn from that. So if you do something else with business partners, for example, the butchers, you need to have the same, the person, the butcher has to have the same. So that's hence why the butchers is successful, because Andy, the business partner, is the same person.
Yeah.
And that's really important.
Yeah, and there's more to businesses than just making money.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah.
It is. It's about people, and it's about an understanding. And now I get people like Richard Branson and Lord Sugar and, you know, guys that go on and their excitement for business is about making money. That's what drives their business. It's not about necessarily their enthusiasm for life is about that's making money. Like, my enthusiasm for it is, and that's where they get their kick from.
I think, yeah, Lord Sugar does. I think Richard Branson is really involved in world issues and stuff as well.
I think
well.
He is so now, because he's got so much money, he's got nothing else to do.
All right, what mistake do people make? I tell you what we should do on this one. We should do cooking.
Okay.
What mistake do people make when they're doing cooking?
Well, I mean, we've probably already covered it, but you've got to read the recipe first before you actually cook the dish. Read the recipe first. Make sure you understand it, then cook the dish. And if you can, do the prep, the chopping, the prep stuff beforehand. Like, it feels like it's always cooking
that.
In backwards.
I do it like I'm on telly now.
Yeah.
So I chop it all like Simon does, yeah. And I get it all in little bowls, then I cook.
And how much easier does it make it?
Yeah, I always imagine there's a camera. And
do you talk to yourself as you're going along?
And now I'm...
Are you interviewing a different guest
exactly.
every time as you're cooking?
Exactly, yeah. where are you on seasoning food? Because what I've learned from Simon, let's do a steak, for instance. You get a good piece of meat, get it room temperature.
Yeah.
He taught me that, and it does work.
Yeah.
Letting it rest works, we know. But season heavily. So we season heavily with salt and pepper or whatever you're going to do, but generally salt. How are you with that?
Yeah, I'm a massive seasoner of salt. I like it. And I know that there's salt gets a big kickback, and everyone says that, you know, there are salt contents and it's unhealthy. And that I agree wholeheartedly with all of that. Like, you know, you'd be a fool not to. But at the same point, I do think that food needs to taste amazing. And if you are eating, you're not going to cook like that every week. You know, you might cook a steak like that maybe once a week, once every 2 weeks, something like that.
Yeah.
And you go, you season it properly, make sure it's tasty, make sure it's flavoursome. So yeah, I'm in the Simon camp that seasoning is good.
Yeah.
Seasoning is great. It makes things taste lovely.
Any life hacks? These could be travel tips or anything you want.
Yeah, for me, it's all like always travel on a plane in comfortable trousers. That's the one thing. Like, I won't get on a plane unless I'm wearing a nice pair of tracky bottoms. I hate it, even if it's a short flight, like feeling weird in jeans and a belt and a thing. And if you can
really
take your shoes off as well, because and get up and walk. Like, I hate, like, I do quite like plane travel. I love travel. But at the same point, it's got to be comfy.
See, and I
like, even if you're in like budget seats and you're next to each other and squashed up, you've got to try and make yourself feel comfy.
Yeah, but I always think if it crashes, I'd rather be in jeans.
Would you?
Yeah.
Why is that?
I just think I'd survive better in jeans than a pair of tracksuit bottoms.
Yeah, they're thicker,
aren't
they? Yeah. They're thicker than a pair of velour tracksuit bottoms. You've got more like, less likely of your legs getting ripped apart in a pair of jeans
and
in a plane crash.
They got pockets as well, and you can carry stuff in pockets. Do you know what I do? Is I generally, when I've got take off and landing, and also most of the journey as well, I try and make sure I have my passport still on me and my money in case we crash. Then at least I can get out of the country in my bag.
You've actually thought about this quite a lot, haven't you?
I have thought about crashing a lot, yeah. Doesn't everyone, when they get on a plane, with those stupid idiots, stand up there and go, if the plane crashes, like, don't tell me the plane's going to crash. I don't want to know.
I have to be honest. I've given up paying attention to that because I just go, do you know what? If we hit the ground at 350 miles an hour...
We're dead.
No one cares where the nearest exit is.
Right,
there'll be a lot of exits.
Right. Do you not go in there? Because I'm kind of on that same thing, but when I go in, I go, where's my nearest exit?
Yeah.
And then I go, just remind myself, where's the life jacket and where does the oxygen come from? Oxygen comes from above, life jacket comes from below.
I do check that just in case. Just in case.
And then when we're flying business or first, as we do, Tom, these days, you know, successful guys like us, where on earth have they hidden the life jacket on this on this bed I'm lying on?
No, I'm more like, where's my hot towel?
They're actually putting double beds in them now, I think.
Are they?
Yeah, apparently. But you know, they always say keep your seatbelt on in turbulence. What happens if you're in a double bed? Where do you what? You're gonna have a double seatbelt across the double bed? I don't know. Anyway, not for likes of me. Right. So we've done life hacks, comfortable trousers. Any books you recommend?
The one that you've given me here looks amazing. The things you can see only when you slow down.
Yeah.
LaRousse Gastronomique is another amazing one.
Right.
To be honest, if it's about inspiration, it is for me. It's the White Heat Cookbook, and that transcends for so many different things. So it's Marco Pierre White's White Heat Cookbook.
Well, the one you spoke about earlier.
Yeah, the one I spoke about earlier. But that's because it not only is it it's an exceptional chef book, but it's a beautiful coffee table book. And and if you dig deeper into it, it's an incredible journey of the British food scene. So Marco Pierre-White's White Heat.
Okay, what colour is it?
It's black and white. It's black and white. We could swap out LaRousse for it.
Maybe I'll do a monochrome shelf.
Yeah,
just do black white.
Yes.
This is a really unfair question. You can say if you don't want to answer it at all. Where would you go to eat? Is there anyone's restaurant you'd like? Is that too hard for a chef?
There are so many places, and we're very, very lucky. And so much of food really does depend on the mood. And more importantly, the company you're with and the sort of thing we get. Like we said earlier, like some of the best meals you could be having is fish and chips on a beach in the wet and cold. But if you were looking for a very special occasion dinner to go and have something that's amazing or a lunchtime, I would say Claude Boz's Bibendum restaurant in London, he's a 2 Michelin star chef that's well on his way to 3 stars. I mean, he's a phenomenal cook, and it's in the old Michelin building in Chelsea. And it's
I've been there.
Yeah, it's amazing.
They have the oyster bar on the ground. That's not his, is it?
He's taken over that as well, so he's making the oysters and caviar space, and it's very simple cooking. But upstairs, that dining room, it's all being through renovation. It's beautiful, thick plush blue carpets, but the stained glass on the summertime in the sunshine coming through that window is amazing.
It's got Conran in there, hasn't it?
And it's exceptional food. It's absolutely, and it's a very special place, so that's a special occasion, amazing place to go.
I'll try that one. Okay. What is the meaning of life?
To be honest, like all of us, I think we're probably all trying to work it out. But for me, it's weird because you question it more when my son's 2.5 years old. And it's the first time I've started asking that, because before I didn't really, it made no sense. I didn't really care. But it is now, I'm so much more trying to find a balance between work, life, happiness, even though my work isn't work, but you do find yourself doing things that then don't involve you, means you're missing out him. So I think the meaning of it is just finding a balance of happiness and time. And I think after that, you can't ask for much more else, can you?
Not really. Thanks so much for doing the podcast. If people want to follow you,
I am on Twitter.
What's your Instagram name? What's
at
your Twitter name?
Chef Tom Kerridge, and they're both the same. At both Chef Tom Kerridge.
If people want to book into your restaurants, what's the waiting list like?
It depends. The coach is completely non-bookable. He's just turned up. The Hand of Flowers for a weekend is about 5 to 6 months.
Wow. That's brilliant, isn't
for
it?
A weekend. Yeah, well, it is and it isn't. It's something that, from a business point of view, you go, that's amazing, we're fully booked for them. But actually, from my point of view, we set up to be an accessible kind of local pub restaurant, and now we're, you know, people are booked 6 months in advance. It makes it almost not accessible, and that on a personal scale, it's something that it does grate on me a little bit. But from a business point of view, it allows you to grow. And so I'm caught in a little bit of a dichotomy of whether I like it or not.
How many? You must keep tables back though, mustn't you?
No, we don't do that. No,
for your celebrity friends.
We have 4 bar stools at the bar that are non-bookable.
You can always slide Tim Lovejoy in, can't you?
Tim Lovejoy, we will always find a table. Tim Lovejoy, we will always find a table. But we have turned the likes of, sadly, away David Beckham. We have turned, like,
really?
We've got 15 tables, and we have 4 bar stools that are non-bookable. But if, you know, if you were to ring up Tim, we'd go, yeah, let's squeeze Tim on the bar, that's no problem. But they didn't want to sit at the bar, so you go, well, what can you, and you understand that, because, and if you've only got 15 tables and you can't do it, then you can't do it, can you? You know, and with all due respect to David Beckham, phenomenal guy, amazing ambassador, great football player. Think of all the clubs he played for and how amazing. What a phenomenal career. I think he's incredible. From a restaurant point of view, is he any more important than Dave from Bolton, who's been waiting 6 months to get in? He's no more important.
Right, that's a good attitude, and he'll understand that.
Yeah, you'd hope he would.
Well,
I hope he has. He hasn't tried booking again since. So.
Maybe he didn't. Mate, that's fantastic. Thank you so much again for doing the podcast. It's been brilliant, and we'll see you back on Sunday Brunch very shortly, I hope.
Pleasure. I can't wait, mate. Thanks, Tim.
Cheers, mate. That's Tom Kerridge. What a lovely bloke he is. I learnt lots. I think he's just a really, really nice person. He's got a lot of good stories there. And I think he had to get out quickly because you like him too much.
Oh, I bent his ear a bit at the end, didn't I? I told him about my homemade ice cream recipe as well. Oh, that's so embarrassing.
Yeah, I was embarrassed for you. No, you. No, I like the fact that you were doing that with him. And then he came back with a, you sort of gave him an alien substance that no one knows of. And he came back with another one.
Yeah.
What was your substance?
Xylitol.
What the hell is that? It can't be good for you.
Look it up, Tim. Look it up. You know, you like your Google thing. I won't put the jingle in. I'll talk over you while you're doing it.
Okay.
It's made from the bark or the sap of, I think
birch. What's it called?
Xylitol. Right. XY.
Well, you're already like, I've got it, yeah.
Yeah.
What a ridiculous thing. What sort of word begins XY?
And it's a sugar substitute that has much less carbohydrates and sugar than sugar.
It says here poisons you.
Oh, God, yes, because everyone has to disagree with everything, don't they?
It says xylitol, it's natural sweetener, which poisons your liver. And it doesn't really. It says is a sugar alcohol used as a sweetener.
Yeah, and
it's
actually actively good for your teeth. So if you have it before you go to bed, you can get a little chirm like... they're called peppersmiths that use xylitol to make their sweets. And then it said you can have them before you go to bed.
May reduce tooth decay. Its formula is CH2OH bracket CHOH bracket 3 CH2OH.
You can't say that this podcast isn't informative, can you?
That's very funny. That just doesn't sound very... healthy.
Everything has that. You look up this. That's just the makeup. That's a molecular makeup, isn't it? Everything has a molecular makeup. Even your stupid face has a molecular makeup.
It may cause a gastrointestinal discomfort.
Yeah, you get a bit windy.
Flatulence.
You get a little bit windy.
And diarrhea.
No, nonsense. You have to.
Irritable bowel syndrome.
You have to have sort of 20 teaspoons a day of that to even get that. So, I use a couple.
So what do you... talk us through the recipe very quickly.
Coconut milk in a pan on the hob, low. Put the xylitol in it so it sort of dissolves into the... Like you dissolve sugar into the coconut milk, and then a sort of tablespoon of... cocoa powder, which doesn't have any sugar in it. So you have a sugar-free ice cream, and it's very good.
Like most sugar alcohols, xylitol has a laxative effect because sugar alcohols are not fully broken down during the digestion. However, that effect varies from person to person.
It's like, you know, people use stevia. It's a natural sugar.
No, what's that? What was the thing he came back with?
I have heard of it when he said it and I can't pronounce it.
Ethitol.
Maybe something like that. But stevia is a plant-based one that you can use. But apparently I don't use it because it's got quite a distinctive flavour.
Xylitol is fatal to dogs. Dogs can't eat it.
It's amazing that I tell you about a thing that I think you'd like and you find everything wrong with it.
You know what?
It makes you a bit windy.
You know what, Mark?
You can't feed chocolate to dogs.
Mark, can't you? Oh, yeah, I know that. You know what? I'm just doing my research. So will you bring some ice cream around next time you come?
I will.
Actually, you can't. It'll melt by the time you get it. It takes you about 3 hours, doesn't it? Trains
it should take
late.
Me about 40 minutes.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, that's fantastic. I thought Tom was amazing.
He was brilliant.
What a lovely bloke.
Yeah.
Just really good. Hope you enjoyed that. Please let us know what you thought of it. Contact us as always. You can tweet me at Tim Lovejoy. You can email us dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. Subscribe to us, rate us 5 stars if you want. We will see you all very shortly. So for the time being, peace and love, Joy.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, written and hosted by Tim Lovejoy and produced by Mark Augustine. If you would like to contact us, then our email address is dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. Or Tim is on Twitter @TimLovejoy and on Instagram @TimLovejoy_official.